Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Hello, and welcome to the Songs of Note podcast. I'm so glad you're here today. Today, we are talking about a band called The Replacements. And I imagine that makes some of you jump up and down, and some of you go, who? So The Replacements are an incredible band. They were mostly in the 80s, led by frontman Paul Westerberg, who is just an incredible songwriter. They have a number of just classic songs, but they were also a band that was marked by what you could almost call self-sabotage in some ways. Like they would be like they were going to get real popular, and then they wouldn't. And they just had a lot of ups and downs in their career, but they made music that people just connect to so deeply, and fans do so deeply, and we talk about that in the interview. I'm interviewing Bob Mayer, who wrote a book on the band, Trouble Boys, The True Story of The Replacements. I like this book so much, and I'm going to put a link to the book in the show notes. But Bob actually got to interview Paul Westerberg and the guys from the band, and he'll talk about that here in a minute. But just really enjoyed this interview. If you're listening, be sure and subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. I love to do episodes on all kinds of bands and the stories behind songs and albums, and I would love for you to be able to catch up on even previous episodes. There's more than 70 episodes that have already been recorded that you can go back and listen to. Also, come find me on social media. I'm on Instagram at Songs of Note. You can find me on Facebook. There's a private Songs of Note Facebook group. I'm on Twitter. I would love to connect with you and talk music. So without further delay, this is Bob Mayer. Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about The Replacements today.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed your book. I actually enjoyed it so much I bought it twice. I bought it a hardback copy and on Audible, so I could catch up with all things Replacements. I just love this band, and I was so glad that there's actually a proper biography written on these guys, because I think it's such a special group. So I'm curious for you, what made you want to write about the band?
Well, kind of that same thing you're expressing there in terms of a proper biography. I mean, the Replacements have been written about quite a bit over the years. I mean, they're not although they're considered kind of a cult band, they certainly weren't obscure or unknown. There was a lot of ink spilled about them over the years. And there was a couple attempts to sort of write about them, you know, a little bit more. Michael Ozerot had a chapter in his Our Band Could Be Your Life, and Jim Walsh wrote a kind of oral history about them in 07. But you know, they didn't really have the participation of all the members or the key members. And so my kind of feeling was there was more to the story that, you know, had been untold or uncovered or hadn't been uncovered. And so I felt like, you know, I really want to tell this story just kind of instinctively. I didn't know, obviously, from the outset exactly where the story would take me and all the sort of corners that it would go. But I just felt like intuitively that this is such an amazing band and there's such an amazing story, but there's more to the story than we know, surely. And so I spent a couple of years really trying to secure the band's participation, or crucially the participation of the Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson, the main members. And so that was kind of my thing. It's like, you know, I wanted to make sure they were going to be on board and involved, and yet it was not an authorized bio. It was still sort of up to me to tell the story as I saw fit without any kind of interference or need for approval. But, you know, ultimately that was my thing. And obviously I thought it was going to be, as I told my editor, I thought it'd be a 2-year process, a year of research and a year of writing. It ended up taking about 6 or 7 years all told, from me signing the deal to getting it published, and, you know, even going further back than that, almost a decade in total. So, and some of that was complicated by the fact that the band reunited in 2013 as I was kind of wrapping up the book, and they were together for a couple of years. So I sort of waited on that. So, you know, it had an unusual gestation that was quite a bit longer than I would have anticipated. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's sort of what the story required too. You know, it required me to kind of hang with it and be there and sort of keep coming back to it and coming back to different people in interviews over a period of years, and, you know, really establishing a trust with some of the key people in the band and their management and their families and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, it was one of those things. My motivation was, as a fan of their music and as a journalist, I and you know, someone who's done investigative stuff and looked at people's lives and their artistry, I just felt like, man, there's something here. And I started chasing it. And then it took me down a long and road for many years.
Well, I'm so glad it's not an authorized fan biography, because I feel like that would take all the teeth out of something. Like, it just, if there's any band that didn't need to have an authorized biography, I think it's The Replacements.
Yeah, I mean, know what I mean? It's true, but you know, I have to credit the band because, one, for sticking with me through the process, because obviously, you know, year after year, I'm going to Minneapolis and interviewing Westerberg or interviewing Stinson, and it's like, when is this book coming out? You know, but I think but even from the outset, they understood, you know, one of the things that Paul said to me, he's like, you know, if you do this book and you do it right, it's not always going to make us look the best, or it's not going to be the happiest story necessarily. But the only way for you to do this, and the only reason I want it done, is for you to do it honestly. And so, you know, credit to them. I had the kind of best of all worlds, where it was done with their participation, but without the need for their authorization in terms of the finished product. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that keeps the teeth in it, but you know, they wanted the story, the real story told, because that's just, you know, that's the kind of people they are. They're not sort of people who tend to pull their punches or really ever sugarcoated anything in their career or were worried about how they looked or how they appeared or how they came off. So it was kind of the right fit for the band's story that I was telling, you know, the approach I ended up taking.
It sounds like it. Well, so with the book, you open with the funeral of Bob Stinson.
Right.
Why did you start there?
Well, that was... you know, I mean, I could have started at any number of points. I felt like, you know, you could start with them at their peak or at the beginning, do a chronological thing. But I felt like so much of, as I came to realize in researching the book, so much of the story emanated from Bob Stinson's life and his, what he went through in his childhood and where his kind of personal journey took him. That was really kind of the crux, or certainly one of the pillars of what this band was about, and certainly why he formed the band with Tommy Stinson and Chris Marrs initially, and then Paul Westerberg came on board. So it felt like, you know, Bob was so much at the heart of the story of the band's formation. And even after he left the band, he was still had such a profound, even spectral presence in what they did, you know. Even after he was gone, he was so much the animus and the heart and the soul of the story that it felt like to sort of shy away from his end, you know, or put it, relegate it to the end of the book or kind of an epilogue or whatever. It didn't feel right. It felt like this was the moment really that the story kind of led up to. And so then I start, you know, you're telling it, you jump back in time and start telling, how did we get to this point? In a weird way, that was his passing happened in 95, and his funeral was really kind of the first reunion of the band, in a sense, after they broke up in 91, and it was the first time that everybody was in one place. And so it was a kind of, you know, both symbolic and kind of a literal kind of reunion moment. And so, it felt like, you know, I could have, any story you can tell 100 different ways, and I could have opened it, you know, any of a number of a dozen ways that would have made sense. But it felt like to me that was the gut punch of the story, and that's the place to start and then go. You know, I know some people have accused it of being like, you know, it starts with a funeral and gets more depressing from there. But, you know, it's in some ways it's a sad story. In many ways it's a triumphant story. And I think, you know, it was just the kind of, that was the starting point of what obviously becomes a much bigger epic kind of tale of four people's lives, or five people's, six people's lives, you know.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a somber and like appropriate choice after reading it. It kind of set the tone for this is what's going to happen, and now let's go look back at all the good and all the real of all the things that happened. With the band, can you tell a little bit about how did they meet initially?
It was basically a band of brothers. First, Tommy and Bob Stinson. Bob's born in 59, Tommy's born in 66. So, you know, they're half brothers, actually, different fathers. Bob and his mom, Anita, they're from Minnesota originally. She divorced Bob's dad. They led out to California just to kind of escape what was a pretty bleak, you know, existence there, and got out to California, met Tommy's father, and she settled with him, although she never really got divorced from her first husband. And so, what happened to Bob is he was basically subject to a series of abuses, verbal, physical, mental, sexual, you know, at the hands of his stepfather. And eventually, Anita, Tommy, and her other kids, they sort of left, you know, kind of in night fled from him, moved back to Minnesota. When they moved back to Minnesota, Bob, you know, as a result of all this stuff that the mom was not fully aware of, started acting out. And it sort of sent him, the abuses that he suffered kind of sent him into the juvenile state system, to juvenile jails, group homes, that kind of stuff. And it was really there that he had started playing music, but it was there through music and being kind of isolated for a period of years in this, you know, state system, that he really kind of embraced the guitar and music and made it his goal to start a band. And so when he got out of that state system, when he was 18, he came home, and his younger brother, Tommy, 11, 12 years old, he's already going down a bad path of, you know, shoplifting, getting arrested. And so he sort of quite literally stuck the bass in his hands, said, I, you know, play the bass, be in my band, let's be a band. And that's really how it got started. And then they met Chris Mars, who was a neighborhood kid. And then the three of them were playing for about a year and a half or so, kind of on a much, you know, small level, keg parties and just sort of playing in their basement, making a racket. And then Paul Westerberg, who'd had his own kind of personal journey and had been playing as a kind of lead guitar player in a bunch of bands in town. He heard them on his way back home from work as a janitor, and sort of heard them playing, snuck in the bushes and listened to them. And then eventually, through a kind of fortuitous series of circumstances, he was brought over to their house. And, you know, that's where the magic happens. It's sort of the union of the Stinson brothers and Chris Mars and Paul Westerberg, and that forms the Replacements. And very quickly, they had obviously a tremendous chemistry and magic together, you know, for lack of a better term. And that's sort of where the journey of the band starts. But, you know, it's most band stories, I suppose, aren't, you know, the sort of origin story isn't that interesting or isn't that important. You know, bands tend to evolve and become what they become together. But I think in the case of the Replacements, almost to a man, each of them had something in their personal backgrounds and their childhoods that drove them to music, that drove them to the lives that they had, and drove them ultimately to each other and to form this thing. They all came from some, to varying degrees, of abuse, alcoholism, depression, a kind of, you know, they were the children in some cases of World War II veterans. And it was a different era, you know. Paul and Bob were born in 59, Chris in 60, Tommy in 66. But, you know, they were from it's hard to look back now because, you know, we think of them as a modern band, but they really came from another world and another time, I think, in terms of their rooting and their families, where, you know, you didn't talk about your problems and you solved everything with drinking or, you know, it wasn't as expressive. And so I think the way they expressed themselves, the way they sort of rose above what were pretty limited prospects for them, they were all kind of essentially high school dropouts, was through the music and through this band. And I think that in and of itself gave a particular kind of power and importance to what they did. And you know, then that, and also put some limitations on them as well professionally, you know, which is what the story, you know, becomes as it unfolds as we go through, you know, the next 10 years of their career as a band together.
Well, I thought it was interesting. You had a quote from Paul Westerberg saying that their options were jail, right, death, or janitor. Right. And I was like, oh my gosh, where are you guys coming from? Right. Oh man, that's a dark outlook. I don't know if he said that in jest or not. I don't think he did.
No, but, I mean, I think it's quite true. And if you look at a lot of the people that you know, they knew or came up with, that was kind of the options. It was either a very bleak or workaday kind of blue collar existence in terms of janitor, or it was jail, or it was death. I mean, in Bob's case, it kind of did become death, and he was a janitor and Paul was a janitor, you know what I mean? It's
wow.
I just think when you look at a lot of bands now, and it's not to sort of, you know, look down on it, it's just, I think they had more sort of, there was more at stake for them in terms of the band becoming something. It was more a vehicle to sort of, you know, these guys, they weren't, as Paul said, you know, that was one of the reasons why I think he was attracted to the Stinson brothers and Chris Mars, is he found in them a similar kind of desperation that he didn't find in some of the other guys he knew, maybe the more middle class or upper middle class guys who, as he puts it, were going to go off to college or go become accountants or whatever. You know, he needed to find somebody who had and a group of guys and a band that had the same level of desperation as him. And I think, you know, obviously that's, I think, at the core of what made them. I mean, yes, they had some things in their shared backgrounds in terms of where they came from and the sort of circumstances that they rose out of. But it was also a fact that, you know, their futures wouldn't, you know, these were guys that, if not for the band, you know, they weren't going to be world beaters. They weren't going to be CEOs, you know. I mean, it was sort of, so I think when he says it was jail, death, or janitor, if not for the band, that's, you know, that's not a joke. That's pretty true. And you know, pretty conclusively so.
For people who don't know the band, it seems from the outside that so much of what they did came across as just not caring, or came across as if they had a blasé attitude to their career or to their choices. But the truth is, to be a popular, to be successful, but a band that we're still talking about all these years later, there is so much work and ambition and like talent, and it's such a combination of things. Like, do you think that they were trying to portray more of an image of not caring, or do you think they truly were flying by the seat of their pants and they just happen to be super talented? Or
well, what's your take on that? I think it's no one thing. I think certainly early on, and you know, one of the things that we explore in this work we're working on, and it's coming out in October, is a box set documenting their debut album and the stuff leading up to it as a deluxe edition of Sorry Ma Forgot to Take Out the Trash, which came out in 1981. And one of the things that we tried to do with the box, in you know, putting all this material from that era on there, is you hear just how hard they were working and how quickly they evolved, and that evolution came about as a result of their hard work. Now, later on, I think the period where they became popular or even sort of somewhat famous in the mid-80s, you know, with Let It Be in 84 and Tim in 85, they had become a different band then, and the circumstances were different. They approached things differently. But yeah, you're correct. No band can become as good as them, no matter how talented, unless there's a lot of, you know, blood, sweat, tears, and toil sort of spent to get to that point. And they certainly did that early on. And I, again, because I think they knew this was their one, as Paul puts it, you know, our one road up and out of what their lives would have been. But it was also true that even from the beginning, and certainly throughout their career and their later career, they were not, let's say, business-minded or professionally minded necessarily. And it wasn't so much that that was a pose, although I think at some points in their career, they did sort of wear it as a badge of honor and became part of their presentation, whether it was drinking or blowing shows in front of label executives, that kind of thing. But the truth of it was, their mental makeup also made them, you know, they were easily bored. They were by nature contrarians. They were not ones to fake it, you know, Paul in particular. And so if they were bored or tired or hungover or angry, you know, they played that way. And so I think, you know, Paul, as Paul again puts it in the book, he said, you know, we were kind of a unique band in terms of show businesses. You know, we said, take it like we make it. Whatever we are, you know, we're at least real. And again, you know, no band is always 100% one thing. I think at times, sometimes they exaggerated that for effect or to be, as I say, contrarian. But no, I think they certainly started with a certain level of ambition. And I think pretty quickly, you know, that's part of the stories. They were discovered by Peter Jesperson, who was a mover and shaker in the Minneapolis music scene. He was the co-head of Twin Tone Records. He found them and signed them very early on and started taking care of them. And so I think once they got to that point, and over the next few years, their attitudes changed. But if you look at the first couple of years of the band, they were incredibly hardworking, you know, rehearsing every day and working on the songs. And that's something, like I say, some of the stuff that's on this forthcoming box set. You really hear the work and the refinement and the craftsmanship, even in what are a batch of, you know, kind of snotty, punkish songs. And you also hear the talent that was so clearly there from day one. So, yeah, it's not that they were ever any one thing, but I think they evolved and changed the same way, you know, people do as they go from their, you know, late teens into their early 30s, which is kind of what the life of the band was for them.
Right. Well, for the box set, how did you get involved with actually being part of the song choice or being part of the process of getting to be on that side of things? That's super cool.
Yeah. Well, when the book, even before the book came out in 2015, when the band was in the midst of, they did a sort of reunion victory lap of sorts, 2013 to 2015, where they're playing festivals and doing shows and stuff like that. And at that point, when they were together, I was sort of in the latter stages of doing research for my book. And one of the things, or some of the things I'd done in terms of researching, it was really going through the audio archives as well. I had access to the Twin Tone Records archives, to the Warner Brothers archives, and the band was signed initially for the first four albums to their hometown indie Twin Tone, and then moved on to Sire Records, which is part of the Warner Brothers family. So I had gone through probably, you know, more than anyone had at that point, the kind of recorded legacy and archive. And I had proposed to them in the midst of this reunion, you know, you guys really should kind of dig deeper into the vaults and put out some of the stuff that hasn't been released. And so I kind of created an overall plan campaign of sorts for what, you know, ended up being this has been a reissue series. We started in 2017 with the release of a live album called For Sale, Live at Maxwell's, 1986, which was kind of the Tim era with Bob, the original foursome, doing a really incredible set. It had been recorded professionally by Warner Brothers, but never released at the time. And so we put that out, and that was such a success, you know, in terms of numbers and the response, that we did another project in 2019, which is a little bit more ambitious, as an actual boxed set called Dead Man's Pop, which was a kind of reworking of their 1989 album Don't Tell a Soul, with a completely new mix as the band had intended, another live show from the era, and various other you know, tracks. And then last year we did a deluxe edition of their 1987 album Pleased to Meet Me, which was, you know, one of the times they were in the studio the longest. And then so I've been kind of been part of this process, and I just sort of ended up being the, as I always say, I spent so many years researching the Replacements, 8, 9, 10 years, that I have a PhD in replacement studies. So I kind of was the person that got tasked with kind of putting the campaign together, and have been producing, co-producing with Jason Jones at Rhino Records, and in the case of this upcoming one, Peter Jesperson as well. He was on board for it. So it's been really great, because for me, it's like, you know, I wrote about a lot of this stuff, a lot of this unreleased material, a lot of these recordings in the book, but they hadn't been out. And so since then, you know, it's almost kind of feels like an extension of the work I was doing with the book, in terms of allowing the public now and the fans to be able to hear this stuff that, you know, I had been privy to while I was researching, and now it's kind of available. And I think what we hope we've done is expand on their legacy and their creative legacy specifically. You know, as you note, a lot of what the perception about the Replacements is that, you know, they were kind of, you know, crazy drunken rock and rollers. And that reputation sometimes, I think, obscures the fact they were also very talented musicians. Paul was a great songwriter. The band were great artists and players, and they made great records. And so, so we're just, like I say, kind of shining a light back on the actual music, I think, with this series. And you know, the response has been pretty fantastic. You know, Maxwell's was like charted on Billboard, was their highest charting Billboard album. I was lucky enough to get a Grammy for my liner notes to the Dead Man's Pop Box set. And
I saw that. That's awesome.
And you know, people have really dug this stuff. So it's, you know, we're kind of in the, we're just catching it, you know, the era of physical product and deluxe box sets. You know, who knows how long it'll last, but I think it's good after, you know, 25 years, basically, or 20 plus years after the band broke up, to finally really be able to get and do the deep dive catalog stuff on this stuff has been fun. And I think good for the band and for the fans.
Oh yeah. I mean, especially, yeah, as fans of the band, anytime you can unearth new stuff, especially when it's quality, that is like the most fun thing. I was looking back, and I was, you know, trying to rank their albums for myself. And for me, Let It Be is probably my favorite. I love the story, how you talk about how they chose the name for that album.
Right.
I wonder if you would, one, would you tell that story briefly on how they named it? And then also your thoughts on Unsatisfied. And it's such a popular song for them, but it sounded like it was something that kind of came together in a couple takes.
Yeah.
But I think that's what makes it so special.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's funny that the Let It Be story, they were picking an album, or they're trying to find an album title. And, you know, their manager, Peter Jesperson, was a massive, massive Beatles fan. And you know, as is their want, they were sort of having a little fun with him. And they said, well, we're going to name the album the next song that comes on the radio. And sure enough, it's Let It Be by the Beatles, which is also their album title, which, you know, I think confused people. It was a kind of inside joke that ended up being
a
public joke. And of course, the joke was their next album was called Tim, but they were going to call that Let It Bleed after the Stones record. But they were talked out of that, I think, talked out of that. But, you know, and Unsatisfied, I mean, Paul sort of always dismisses it as a, you know, it's just one line. But, you know, with a lot of his stuff, I think he is a very, you know, kind of quicksilver artist. It's about finding moments, and it's not so much about, I mean, he can be a song craftsman, and there are certain things, like, say, Here Comes a Regular, that he did revisions and drafts and tweaked, but he's one of those guys, he sings songs live on stage, he sings them differently every time, or he would even write songs and leave a couple, you know, verses blank and kind of make them up in the studio. So he's always been about, I think, for his own mindset, because he gets bored very easily and gets tired of things, he has to leave, you know, holes where he can be spontaneous and create on the spot. And I think Unsatisfied is in a way an extension of that. Yeah, maybe it's not the most kind of realized song lyrically or whatever, but you just feel the passion and the pathos and the emotion in his delivery and his performance, and, you know, in the conceit of the song from the beginning. And so I think, you know, he's what's what's good about him and what's bad in the sense of a commercial sense that maybe has kept them from being multi-million sellers is, you know, he thinks and records and performs, and that's what his artistry is. So much of it is about spontaneity. So much of it about is about emotion less than craft, you know, rather than craft. So, you know, that's a great example of that. I mean, it's one of their iconic songs, and, you know, yeah, it's a one or two takes or whatever, you know, so.
Yeah, I don't remember who it was, but one of the band members was expressing regret over if we had just gotten to practice it one or two more right. times, it would have been so much better. But I think if I remember, I think you had said that Paul's opinion was the magic is that it was just after learning it a couple times they recorded it and it's done. It's captured. It's done. And
yeah, it's.
But I mean, is there anybody that could squeeze so much emotion out of one word? Unsatisfied has so much feeling in when he sings it. Yeah. I'm like, man. I love it.
Well, and it's true. It's like, if you look at Paul's career, you know, I mean, he's essentially retired at this point, but, you know, the latter part of his solo career, he was to the point where he was recording in his basement by himself, you know, and the demo is the song, you know? So for him, you know, he's always had a very conflicted and increasingly so relationship with the studio and the process of recording. For someone of his mindset and his temperament, you know, working in a conventional recording studio, certainly in the 80s, you know, it's a lot of waiting around. It's a lot of boredom. It's a lot of repetition. It's a lot of, you know, it's the kind of antithesis of, you know, the way rock and roll was made in the 50s and, you know, up until really the early 60s when everything was just, you know, one track mono recordings, yeah. you know, and yeah. I think he's kind of reverted back to that. So a lot of what are the kind of magic moments in the Replacements catalog are those kind of spontaneous things or are mistakes or are incompleted ideas yet that have their own kind of unique power and beauty. Yeah.
Well, so Androgynous is probably one of my favorite Replacements songs. And it's one of the most different. There's no like big guitar sounds. Right. But it just comes across as so vulnerable and so unique in the way that they would be willing to put themselves out there. It feels like it feels like a bold step for a rock band to do a song like that. You're on a piano and
they were,
you talk about that song.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing that from the beginning, though. The B-side of their first single, I'm in Trouble, was If Only You Were Lonely, which is a kind of, you know, semi tongue-in-cheek country song that actually has a real kind of beauty to it as well. And then by the time they get to Hootenanny, their third album, they're doing things like, you know, Within Your Reach, which is almost like electronic pop with a drum machine, you know, amid albums of, you know, real classic rock and roll or punk influenced stuff. And then, so I think by the time you get to Let It Be, you've got Unsatisfied, you've got 16 Blue, you've got Androgynous. And I think, again, you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, Paul has a very fertile mind. He has a very active kind of sensibility about music and he digests and listens to a lot of stuff. And I think, you know, there's a strain of musicals, of Sondheim, of, you know, Sinatra in what he does. It's always been kind of present, you know, sometimes more overtly than others. But, you know, so I think it might seem in the context of the Replacements that those things are sort of outliers or weird. But I think if you even really like go back to their very first single, you know, they got a kind of a country barroom lament acoustic, you know, that he's doing on the backside of I'm in Trouble, which is this kind of blistering, you know, punk pop song. So I think it's always been present in there. It just became maybe more pronounced as the career went on for a variety of, you know, internal reasons with the band. I mean, you have to kind of establish yourself, I think, as a band before you creatively and your sound before you can start to veer away from it. But, you know, by the third record, the Replacements were doing that. You know, they were always, as Paul said, you know, it's very easy to get hit if you're standing in one place. So it's much better to move around that no one can throw hit you with a bottle. And so that was kind of the theory that he applied, I think, to his music and to their music. And, you know, not just him, you know, Tommy has an incredible pop sensibility. Bob had a wide range of music he liked, you know, Chris, they all kind of, you know, that's what sort of fed into the band's eclecticism, certainly after their second record. You know, the first couple records had a more a punk energy, if not an actual punk sound. And then the second record, the Stink EP, was a little bit more of a hardcore kind of pastiche because they were in that world. And so they sort of started poking fun at that. But by the time they get to Hootenanny, you know, even Hootenanny, which is their second full length, really their third album, they're doing all kinds of stuff, you know, electropop, blues, you know, punk stuff, weird sort of atmospheric psych stuff. It's all there. And then I think they refined that and it kind of became their own sound once you get to records like Let It Be and Tim and even Pleased to Meet Me. You know, it's got Nightclub Jitters, which is almost like a cocktail jazz, you know. So I think there's on all their albums, or certainly after a certain point, there are these, you know, kind of outlier songs or these weird things. But, you know, if every album has them, they're not really outliers. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, so when you look at the band and you look at a song like Bastards of Young, mm-hmm. which I think is just an incredible song, and it was a popular song, but why didn't a song like that hit on the level of like an REM, or like what was it that kept them from getting totally into the mainstream? Or do you think they did? Do you think they reached their commercial potential?
I think it's two things. I mean, at the time, you have to recall the Replacements were kind of at the leading edge of bands that were being signed. You know, this was sort of after the punk new wave thing. This was kind of out of what was considered the American indie movement. They were really the first band signed out of that movement onto a major label. And so the apparatus, and you also have to realize what was timing is a lot of it, is what it's down to. What was big in 1985? You know, it's Madonna, it's, you know, Van Halen, it's electronic pop and big pop and electronic instruments. And, you know, here's this very rough sounding indie recorded, essentially level recorded record. Now that is an anthem, and it's an anthem today, but I think it's an anthem for all times. It wasn't an anthem for the moment in the 80s. And a lot of that had to do with what radio was going to play, which was really kind of the, you know, coin of the realm was getting played on radio and MTV to a certain extent. And they were just sonically, particularly with that album, which was their first for Warner Brothers on Tim, they were too rough. They were too whatever. I mean, people heard and saw the potential. And I think that's why there were so many big expectations for them. They're like, listen, this band could be an American Rolling Stones. They could be another Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers kind of thing. Yeah. And some of that maybe is true and some of it is exaggerated. I think Paul's music, quite frankly, was too smart, too complicated in terms of an emotional content to really kind of connect with a mass audience at that time. You know, if they'd have been around, he says it in the book, if they'd have been around 10 years earlier when bands like Mott the Hoople or The Faces or Slade were successful, I think they could have fit very neatly in that. If they had come together and been making that kind of music, making a Bastards of Young in the early 90s after Nirvana broke and alternative radio was a real impactful force, they might have made it. But, you know, timing, like a lot of things in life, and especially in the music business and in terms of having hits, timing is everything. Now, I also think there's something inherent in Paul's songs that sort of makes them incredibly important songs, incredibly wonderful songs, and connects with people on a crazy deep level, as I'm sure, you know, if you're a Replacements fan, you know, but that may not connect with the biggest audience. And then I think also, you know, there was, you know, production stuff at the time. And it was just, again, ultimately it comes down to timing and temperament. And I don't think the Replacements had quite the temperament to become pop stars when they, you know, ostensibly could have been. And I don't think the timing in terms of the radio environment, record companies, was right for a band like that to become big. REM does that a few years later, but, you know, REM was a different kind of band. I mean, the Replacements really were a true classic rock and roll band. And I think REM was an enigmatic pop band, and sort of pop bands that have enigmatic frontmen are, you know, and they're sort of an anomaly too, in a way, but you can understand the sort of how they fit into that world. And also they made different choices. They had, interestingly enough, they had Scott Litt producing them.
Yeah.
He was an engineer at the Power Station. He was a real pro guy, spoke the language of radio and radio hits. And, you know, they had a hit with The One I Love because of that. And, you know, Scott Litt was a guy that was supposed to produce the Replacements' second album for Warner Brothers, and they turned him down, you know, and then he went and worked with REM. So, you know, it's choices.
That's crazy.
It's choices. Huh. It's who you work with. At that time, in particular in the 80s, you know, it was music, rock and roll, and radio. You know, it was very much a producer's medium. And so, you know, they went with a guy who got them hits, and the Replacements didn't have the temperament to work with somebody like that, probably. And so, you know, but as I always say at the end of the day, you know, the proof is in the pudding. Let It Be, or rather, you know, Bastards of Young is an anthem. It's a hit in a kind of alternate universe. And people know that song and connect with that song. And it's used in movies and TV and that kind of stuff. So I think it's become a quote unquote hit, but it just took, you know, 30 years for that to kind of happen and for it to seep into the popular consciousness, you know, whereas, you know, REM obviously did it in the moment 30 years ago.
Yeah, what a interesting thing. I've never heard anyone say they made a hit for the ages, but not a hit for their time. Right. That is a great, I mean, that nails it. Well, can you talk about why did Saturday Night Live ban the group? I rewatched that performance recently. Can you talk about that incident a little bit?
That's obviously become kind of a famous thing. It was the first time they were on national TV. Yeah. They were sort of last minute replacements for another act. I think it was Pointer Sisters. And they went on and played, and they did Bastards of Young, Kiss Me on the Bus. It was around the time of Tim. And Warner Brothers had a very good relationship with Saturday Night Live historically. And so they kind of got him on the show as a favor in a sense. And, the performance is fantastic. But if you think about it again in context, when you think about what was on in terms of rock and roll or live music, in the 80s, it was very polished. It was video centric. It was visually oriented. Mm-hmm. It was very sort of produced. And, you watch that performance by the Replacements. I mean, they're loud. The sound is all over the place. They're walking around. Paul's missing cues on his mic, coming back. And I think what I tried to do in the chapter about that, because that's such a flashpoint, moment in their career, because they didn't end up appearing on TV for the next 3 years, for another 3 years at what was really kind of a crucial point of their career is, the context of Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live was in a point where they were on thin ice. The show was, Lorne Michaels had just come back after 4 years. The ratings were a disaster. There was talk of cancellations. And, Paul in the middle of the song yells to Bob, emphatically to play the solo. And he says a curse word, and that kind of slipped past the censors, even though it was, almost inaudible. But, and so basically, Lorne Michaels read him the riot act in between songs. And it's funny, if you watch the second performance of Kiss Me on the Bus, they have to count it off twice because they blow the count off. And then Tommy says, darn, on the mic, kind of making fun of the fact they cursed early. I mean, it's just, if you know the context, and once you read the chapter, all of it makes a lot more sense. But, again, at the time, it was something that, kind of hurt their career and hurt them with Warner Brothers. But now, it's still something people talk about, and it's a famous moment, and it always crops up on the list of the best or most infamous SNL performances. So there again, it's a question of, it was a bad thing at the time, and it's become this legendary thing, for all time. So it's sort of a funny kind of dichotomy of their career. Well,
that's totally right. I mean, that's totally true. Well, it's interesting when you look at fans of the band, and you kind of hit on this, but I don't know how to pinpoint it. Maybe you do, but there's some kinship you feel, some deeper connection you feel with this group. And I feel like it's maybe that you feel like it's your band. It's that not everybody knows how good this is. This is my thing. It's almost like you're discovering them. Even though they're known by so many people, still this element of, I found out about this thing. Like, I remember when I got the Paul Westerberg mono solo album that he put out. And it's a double album. It's one of my favorite records of all time.
Incredible record.
Incredible. Yeah. It's incredible. But my close friends know it, and nobody else that I know knows it. But even getting ready for this episode, I was posting on my Instagram account, some Replacement songs, and I was getting more responses than I ever get. And people were saying, oh, anytime I would go to Minneapolis, I would think about this band, and this band still means so much to me. And I've lived in Minneapolis for 3 years, and I still haven't run into Paul Westerberg or whatever, things like that. Like, what is it about this group that really makes people connect at the heart? What do you think it is?
I think it's, that's one of the things I explore, not so much, explicitly, but it's kind of implicit in the story of the book and of the band. I don't know. I mean, I think my ultimate sense of it is, there's always a kind of feeling of discovery, when a band isn't aren't multi-million house sellers, household names, yet they're as great as the Replacements, and you discover them, you feel a sense of ownership. I mean, I think that was even happening with them at the time. When they went to Warner Brothers, some fans felt like, oh no, now you're getting popular, even though they really were that popular. But, so I think there's that, everybody likes the Christopher Columbus aspects, like, oh, I discovered this band, even though, there's that. I think there's also an element where, their reputation, they're a band that very much existed in an era of word of mouth, it's not like now where everything is documented and filmed and every performance and every gig. And so there was a kind of legend that built up around them, particularly once they started touring and going national in 83, 84, 85, and people really started seeing them en masse all across the country. And they were at their kind of volatile and exciting peak. And so I think the legend sort of grew as a word of mouth. And I think with bands that are based on legend, you know, there's a kind of romance and myth attached to them. So they have that kind of romantic quality. And then I think also, you know, you can't overlook the music and the kind of diversity and evolution of the music, you know, from Sorry Ma to All Shook Down. I mean, almost every record is different. And, you know, if you listen to that first record to the last record, it doesn't even seem like the same band. And in many ways it isn't.
Totally.
So there's a lot to tap into. I think, you know, people who are fans of, you know, the early stuff of love punk rock and that kind of, you know, really visceral rock and roll, there's that. The people who really like that kind of classic rock and roll band, you know, stuff, they have that mid period. And then, you know, there's in the latter stages where it becomes more singer songwriter oriented or pop oriented, there's stuff. So I think, you know, there's something for everyone in their catalog. So I think there's that aspect too. But I think ultimately the thing that attracts people to them and creates this kind of intensity is the fact that most bands, you know, when they get on stage or they're in the studio or they're on TV or whatever, they present themselves a certain way. They're putting on an act or projecting an image. And I think the Replacements never did that. And I think the Replacements music, who they are and what they are and what they played and their songs are much closer to them as people. You know, there isn't any kind of, even though, yes, they Paul was very keenly aware of showbiz and putting on a show in a sense, and they may have exaggerated certain things about them. I think at the end of the day, the ineffable thing, that sort of intangible quality that makes people just really love them is, I think on an unspoken level, you know that these guys are for real, and you know, and you love them for their greatness and their flaws equally. And, you know, you want to root for them. I think that's a lot of what it is. And again, I think for most of their career, it's an unspoken thing, but, you know, audiences are, you know, in the broader sense, are intuitive. They know when somebody's bullshit, somebody's real, and somebody's, you know, really messed up, or somebody's genuine. And I think, you know, the Replacements, you know, it's not so much about authenticity, because that word has been given a kind of bad rep of what is authentic in music. But I don't mean in terms of, like, you know, their musical authenticity. I mean their authenticity as people. I think they really were kind of real people with real problems and real talent and real emotions. And I think all of that is present in their music. And I think even without them saying it or highlighting that or focusing on that, and in fact, in many ways, what they did was to kind of shy away from the intensity and the realness of what was in there. And so they would make a joke of things and a spectacle of things, but you can't, at the core, you can't deny that that's there. And I think audiences, listeners, at least the ones that find them and discover that, that's the kind of unspoken attraction. And I think that's why, in a way, they have survived and thrived over these last 3-4 decades, you know, more than a lot of bands there. I mean, there's a lot of bands, even within their kind of milieu, that sold more records, that were more popular, more successful, had radio hits, and are not remembered and are not revered and are not relevant the way the Replacements are. And I think that's, at its core, it goes back to, you know, what and who they are as people and as artists. And you know, I think, again, that's that exchange with the audience that knows and loves them so much.
Man, I think that nails it. That is so well put. I love it. I love it. And I just feel that so much with the bands I love, some kind of heart connection or deeper connection, that this is my thing. And I love that about Replacements fans. Well, for people listening, I'm going to put a link to Bob's book. It's Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements by Bob Mayer. Bob, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Really enjoyed it. And thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.